With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, welcome to the latest episode of the Driven Celebrities podcast with me, Andy J. Now, as you know, if you're a regular listener, what we do is we take the radio show that goes out on talk radio over the weekend, which is a celebrity chat show that tries to dive into the minds and worlds of celebrities and get something slightly different from them, not just what are they there to sell or there to plug or if they're having a fun day, but we try and do a little bit more with them. And obviously, we then repackage it for the podcast because I'm acutely aware that not everybody has the opportunity to just hang out at 4 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon or 7 o'clock on a Sunday evening and listen to an hour of radio because we live our lives and we have other things to do. Whereas, of course, the advantage and the benefits of a podcast is you download it and you consume it at your leisure, whether you're cooking or running or driving or chilling out in bed or whatever you might be doing. I appreciate you downloading this. I really do. It means a lot to me. And I hope our relationship will be a long and interesting one. And let me tell you about this week's guests, because I honestly have felt really humbled by the conversations that I've had with two of them in particular. And the third one was entertaining, engaging, and a lot of fun. My first guest is Katie Mellower. Phenomenal songstress. She was the biggest UK singer of all time in 2006, I believe, and she's had an incredible number of platinum hits, seven top 10 albums. I mean, just, you know, amazing, amazing talent. Anyway, she obviously has a new album or new single out, and we were there to talk about both of those. And the conversation took a turn that I wasn't expecting. And she was extremely open and honest with me. I hope you enjoy it, and I hope it surprises you in the same way that it surprises me, because my job is to ask the questions and see where the conversation goes. I try not to really plan anything. I know that sounds terrible. It makes me sound like I'm no good at my job, which might be true anyway, but I just try and talk to people in the moment, you know, and obviously I need to know about their career and what they've done and so on and so forth, but I find it's easier to listen and respond than to just kind of follow a set conversation plan. That's my approach to everything, and I hope it works. Anyway, with Katie, first we had a funny moment when, well, you'll hear it, but we discovered that we'd clearly known each other when we perhaps were a little bit intoxicated in the past. neither of us remember it, but there we go. You'll hear that. And then she talks to me about something very personal, and it really surprised me. Then my wonderful friend Gabby Logan. I'm extremely blessed to know a few people that people have heard of. But I'm not blessed because you've heard of them. I'm blessed because they're really lovely people. And I've known Gabby for years. And she is a really, really remarkable woman. The things that Gabby has dealt with in her life and the things that she has had to overcome emotionally, mentally, just, you wouldn't wish it on your enemy, you know, the things that Gabby's had to live through and deal with. And to come out and be the human that she is, she's an inspiration on so many levels. And I think you'll understand why if you hear this conversation with her. You may already know, but she goes into a lot of detail with her backstory. And I don't think it is a hugely known backstory, because people see Gabby as this kind of uber successful. She's the front of all the big shows on the BBC, all the sport on the BBC. Gabby's there, you know, and Amazon football and so on and so forth. You know, the Olympics, the athletics, the football, you know, sports person of the year, etc. Gabby's been there, done that, bought the t-shirt, earned the stripes, and been doing it for a very, very long time. And so I think people just see this kind of super professional, ultra classy lady, and they don't necessarily know more about the lady behind the smile. And well, I think you'll find out a lot about her today. And I think it'll give you an enormous appreciation for who she is. And then my last guest where a lot more lighthearted, I'm pleased to say, but just as interesting and very good value is Rob Rinder, Judge Rinder, who's great. We didn't leave this bit in the radio edit, actually, but when I was talking to him, I made the mistake of, because sometimes I like to Google the guests and tell them what comes up. You know, when you Google someone's name and then it kind of auto-fills in options for you. And so there's this one thing when you type in Judge Rinder or Rob Rinder, and it suggests that Benedict Cumberbatch is married him. And, you know, the way you read that is, what, he's married to Benedict Cumberbatch? But in actual fact, Benedict was the officiator at their wedding. At Judge Rinder's wedding, Benedict was the guy that's saying, you know, will you take your husband to be, and so on and so forth. And so I did chat to him about that without realising, this is on me, without realising that Judge Rinder had actually very recently just got divorced from his husband. So we left that out because much as he took it in a reasonable way, it was a little uncomfortable and a bit squirmy for a while, and we decided that you didn't need to hear that. But if there are enough requests, then maybe we'll pop it on as a bonus bit of the pod, because I own it, he owns it, and we do end up having a bit of a giggle, but we haven't included it in this show because it just didn't really flow right. But it's there for the taking if enough people contact me on social media and say, come on, Andy, we need to hear that bit, because, you know, you've got to wear it, haven't you? Anyway, look, thank you for your company. I hope you enjoy the show. Enjoy it, share it, tell everyone about it, please. And if you'd like to write a review and, you know, share that you're listening on social media, etc., that would be great too, because we're all part of the same team here. This is the Driven Celebrities podcast, and I'm Andy J.
Driven with Andy J on Talk Radio in association with Paramex Digital. You dream it, we bring it to life. Find out more at drivenchat.com.
Hey there, it's Driven here on Talk Radio. I'm Andy J. Now, I've got to say, today's selection of guests, well, I'm really, really chuffed with them. First up, we have a lady who, by 2006, she was the UK's best-selling female artist. She's had 56 platinum awards and 7 top 10 albums. It's Katie Mellower. After Katie, we've got a lady who's been on our TVs for a very long time. She's a household name, and she has so much to say, not just about sport, but about life and how to live, and she's just fabulous. The wonderful Gabby Logan, she joins the conversation. And how do we close out the show after we've had two splendid ladies? With a judge. I'm sure you all know who it is now. Who's the famous celebrity judge? It's Judge Rinder, of course. Rob Rinder is also on the show. I think this is going to be a really special listen. Lend me your ears for the next hour, and we'll do our best not to disappoint. I'm Andy J. This is Driven.
Driven with Andy J on Talk Radio in association with Paramex Digital. You dream it, we bring it to life. Find out more at drivenchat.com.
This is the closest thing to crazy I have ever been. Feeling 22, acting 17. This is the nearest thing to crazy I have ever known.
You're listening to Driven with me, Andy J, and I am so pleased to be able to welcome my next guest. In fact, I wonder if she remembers meeting me, because we've met a few times before, and I get the sense I maybe haven't stayed in her memory. Anyway, she's amazing. I'm thrilled she's going to talk to us now. She's one of the most sensational singers of all time. She's, get this, 56 platinum awards to her name. It is the sensational, the glorious, the drop-dead gorgeous Katie Mellower. How are you doing, Katie?
I'm really good. Andy, what an introduction. Seriously, thank you so much. And regarding remembering you, of course I remember. But, you know, you are really, you're putting me on the spot, but it's just nice to talk to you again, and thank you so much for having me.
The first time we met was a million years ago when I was co-hosting a Record of the Year and you were up for one of the big awards. So this was like, I don't know, like mid-2000s, you know, like 2010 or something. I can't remember. It was a long time ago, like I said. And for some reason, Katie, and I have no memory of this, but your phone number is in my phone, because when they sent me the details to call you, I went to put it into my phone and you were already in there. So that's fun.
That's hilarious. But you've never rang. apart from today.
Yeah, I did.
You,
I did
you never
check.
Call.
We've got no history of sexy texts or anything. I mean, totally failed.
Are you sure?
Oh, bless you.
You had my number. You know, that's brilliant. That's so funny.
I think that's really cool. Although I do also have your husband's number, so that, you know, that's less cool. You know what I mean? It's like, okay, yeah, I got Katie's number, but I've also James's number's also in my phone, so you know, there's that too. But Katie, listen, I'm delighted we're talking again. I want to talk about the album, I want to talk about the video, and all kinds of things. But first, I hope you don't mind. I actually want to talk about you, because, you know, listening to the track and then hearing you talk about it, I can hear the joy in your voice. You know, and I was thinking about this beforehand. You know, you've had seven colossal albums. You know, you've got all these tags that go with your career that are almost intimidating when you think about it. What you have to live up to from album number seven, for the very first album, of course, that kind of dropped, and you've just had success after success after success. And you've had a bit of a pause, you know, you've had a little bit of a break. So coming back with number eight, there's a fair amount of pressure there, isn't there?
There's always pressure. And you know what? I wish I could say that it got easier the more records you make, but it really doesn't. You know, and I think I'm finally starting to realize that every time you begin a new serious work, you know, like a studio album, you're back to square one. You know, you really... If you really want to make it good, you have to just almost like invent everything from scratch. And one of the hardest things is what you're talking about there, which is finding a justifiable reason to do it. Because, you know, there is something very ego-based around being an artist and putting your work out there. And so you kind of have to keep, you really have to have a reason to convince yourself deep down that, you know, it's really worth doing this and continuing and, you know, working even harder than you have before. So yeah, it's not easy.
You know, it's and what I love about that is that, you know, I mean, I don't want to kind of make assumptions here, Katie, but you know, the fact is you've had so much success, and James, of course, former world superbike champion, and you know, has his own musical career as well. So, you know, projecting could be completely wrong, of course, but projecting, my assumption is that the pair of you could live a really comfortable life if you didn't do anything else. You know, you could be fine. Do you know what I mean? You'd be all right. You don't necessarily need to go out there and break the bread, as it were, earn the money. So this isn't necessarily about kind of seeing how much cash you can bring in. This is about passion, right? Isn't it? This is about you kind of saying, I'm expressing myself. This is what I do. I'm an artist and I love it. Am I right there? Or am I being
cheeky? Yeah, it's about, I think it's about, you know, well, your life's work, you know, like for me, the life's work is making records. I'm still deeply fascinated by it. I feel like we have so much more to do in our industry as a whole, like not just me as an artist. And I'm kind of, I don't know, I'm still on the quest to try and find the best way of making records. And then, of course, life changes constantly. So, you know, you want your works to react to that and to talk about that. So yeah, there's a lot in there that you try and put in.
When you're writing, because like you say, you've done the lyrics for A Love Like That, and they're beautiful. Do you find that when you're writing that it's a sort of a form of therapy for you?
It is actually, yeah. It's a form of therapy, but I also try not to use it as a way of just kind of putting in, you know, all the bad things that happen in my life. I actually believe the work itself does help you cope with things that go on in your life. But then I feel like if you keep writing and writing and writing, like I've had it where a transformation happens, where if you really play with a theme or a topic and it clicks into like that next stage, it can seriously transform you, and it can give you a sense of understanding of yourself, which, you know, which you didn't have before. To experience that as you create music and, you know, write lyrics is a seriously profound thing. It's difficult to try and describe it in, you know, in an interview, but I guess you have to try, don't you?
I can ask questions and we can see where we go. I mean, Katie, do you mind me kind of delving down a little bit? Because if you're not comfortable with this, I completely respect that. But it's a known thing, so I feel like it's my kind of job to ask.
Yeah, of course.
This show is about driven. It's about what drives celebrities and achievers, what keeps them going, what makes them stand up when times are tough. You know, we all sort of think of celebrities and famous folk as having an easy life. But actually, more often than not, the more people I speak to, the more I realise that it's quite the reverse. And you yourself, I think it was about a decade ago now, you had a really tough time. You had a nervous breakdown, and you had some time out in a hospital for a few weeks, didn't you?
I did indeed, yeah. But you know what? I think we've now seen this celebrity lifestyle for so many years, and I think most people are aware that it isn't, you know, the glamorous, beautiful life that it appears to be. Like, the spectacle of it has to be the pretense that it's glorious and it's glamorous and it's easy. But I think any intelligent person, you know, can look at what has happened to, you know, some of the greats in our industry and in the film industry to realize that, you know, there's a lot of dangers that come with the job. I find, particularly in the acting business, I really marvel at anyone who decides to go into that profession, because you have to give up your face and your name. And essentially, as an actor, you really are there to serve the vision of the writers and directors and sometimes the film studios. There's an element of that in my job, because I guess, you know, it's my name and face on the front of the record. But I think at least after a number of years of, you know, making records, you start to realize that you can kind of create that world, you know, and you can create the record and the whole vision that comes with it. And so you are sort of holding on to the reins a little bit more than, say, in the acting profession.
Yes.
But about your question about what drives people, well, you know what? I actually think what's more interesting is, and this comes into why I believe I got sick in 2010, you know, once you reach these incredible heights, there is this thing in our culture, or maybe it's just the way I was raised, where, okay, you reach that, but you don't stop to kind of take it in and soak it in and be like, great, you know, that felt awesome. Mm. Let's just relax a little bit. You're instantly in the mode of, okay, what's next? You know, like, how do we get to the next goal? And like, how do we achieve this? And how do we do? I actually think, you know, really, truly great works of art can be created when you sort of take a more holistic approach, and you do let your body and mind to recover and soak in the reality of you know, whatever success you have. Because if you don't, then you're on a constant treadmill, as we all know. I wish I could say I realized it was remarkable and crazy, but because I was so young, you know, there was a part of me that thought this is what happens in the music industry in England. Yeah. And it took me years to actually realize, in amongst my friends, you know, so many people that I know would love to do this job. And actually realizing that these successes don't happen that quickly and that easily. I mean, I was a complete anomaly, really, you know, or our projects were an anomaly. And yeah, it was also, on the other hand, I've always had quite a kind of, I don't know, like, I want to use the word cowboy attitude to life, where I'm like, okay, I'm diving in deep. Let's just have fun. And plus, as I said before, there just wasn't the time, because it was like, okay, now that after the first album, Close Thing to Crazy, being so big, it was like, okay, how do we get Europe, you know? And then it was 9 million bicycles, and it's like, how do we get America and Japan and Australia? You know, that's a crazy formula to always be on that treadmill.
Is this the beginning, do we think, of a kind of raft of activities for you? Because obviously when touring is allowed again, you've got to go gigging. Are we thinking there's going to be time back in the studio again, more albums? Are we looking at number 9, number 10? Are you in the space? What do you reckon?
I hope so. I mean, I'm still really hungry for it. I love what I do. In terms of touring, we have a whole European tour schedule for the autumn. But of course, I can't tell anyone to get any tickets, because we still don't know what's happening with the gigs. But as soon as the shows are allowed to restart and the government's let us, you know, play some shows, I know there's going to be so much, you know, desire to go and see shows. I cannot wait for everything that's to come.
Thank you so much for talking to me today. It's been a real pleasure, and thank you for being so honest and open. It's really nice to have some concentrated time with you today. So I really
appreciate
it. Yeah,
it's good. No, me too. It's good to have a bit of length, isn't it? Awesome.
Yeah. Hey,
thank you.
There's our first sexy text, Katie. You've just nailed it.
Perfect. There you go. You can use it.
When I send that to you, you're going to block me. There it is. Katie, thanks so much. You have
Andy,
a lovely
thank
day.
You.
I wish
thank
you all
so
the
much.
Success, and I can't wait to hear and see everything that's coming from you. It sounds like the good times are going to be rolling and rolling and rolling.
Bless you. Thank you so much. And hopefully we can do this face-to-face next time.
My thanks to Katie Mellower. And don't forget, you can download her album Number 8 right now. After the break, I'm joined by the wonderful Gabby Logan on life, loss, love and lockdown. There you go. There's another L. This is Driven. I'm Andy J.
Driven with Andy J on Talk Radio in association with Paramex Digital. You dream it, we bring it to life. Find out more at drivenchat.com.
On the way, we're going to hear from Judge Rinder, but next up on Driven with me, Andy J, I'm delighted to say my old friend Gabby Logan joined me in the Driven Chat truck, which I'm taking all round the UK to get to your favourite celebrities. We are indeed the chat show that comes to the guest, thanks to the truck that turns into a portable TV and radio studio. I started off by asking Gabby about her MBE that she was awarded at the beginning of the year.
It was a complete shock, you know. I actually got told at the beginning of December, because you have to agree to it before they will award it.
Oh, right. You could refuse, could you?
Yes.
No, and not into that. No.
But apparently, the letter went missing. So I was doing a live match for Amazon. I was up in Manchester. I was in a hotel in Manchester, and my agent called, and she said, "I've got some good news." And of course, when an agent says that, you automatically, don't you, think
what's the gig?
Yeah. You think it's a job. And she said, "I've had a call from the Home Office." So I was thinking, oh my gosh, I'm not ready to go into politics just yet. No. So she said, "I've had a call from the Home Office and they've sent you a letter offering you an MBE and you haven't replied." I said, "I haven't had the letter." I still haven't had the letter to this day. So anyway, I said,
"One of your neighbours is very pretty." Yeah, you know.
I wonder why they were wearing a hat. And so it was all really lovely. And then I had to keep it secret for a few weeks because it came out on the 28th of December, which is my granny's birthday. And I thought, that'd be really, you know, really sweet because obviously very proud and really, really lovely. And so it was a really nice thing, but over Christmas I never told anybody. And my mum was like, "I can't believe you didn't say anything." Then, of course, I managed to get tickets for her and for Kenny's mum to come to my investiture. Yeah. And the whole thing got cancelled because of lockdown. So I still haven't got it yet. I don't think they can take it away, can they? So.
No, I think you're safe. I think you're safe on that front. And presumably, I mean, at the very least, you could have like a Skype call with her match, couldn't you?
Well, I did say to my agent, because she said, "Oh, should I just scrub this out of the diary now?" Because it was in June the 2nd. I said, "Yeah, but if they ring up and try and do this on Zoom, this is one thing I'm not going to do on Zoom." It's like, can you imagine just going, just imagine I'm pinning something to you. Yeah, so hopefully they'll all kind of get going again next year. But I can't imagine the Queen wanting to do big public events like that anymore.
I can't imagine the people around her feeling like it's a good idea, right?
No, I think there'll be young royals only out there.
And that's they're becoming limited as well.
There's a few
point.
Of those.
I can think of one. You kind of know who you're going to meet now. But I mean, the lovely thing is that it was obviously for your contribution to broadcasting, but also recognition of all the charity work you do. Something that you alluded to actually with all the charity requests coming in. I don't mean this to sound a bit silly, because you know it's a daft question in a way. But is there quite a lot of pressure to being Gabby Logan?
When I first started out in the industry, and I had just absolutely no profile whatsoever, and I was really flattered to be asked to be involved in various charities. And my brother had died before I started my career. And so we'd had a trust kind of charity in his name that was to do with what he died of, which was hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. So the British Heart Foundation always kind of got in touch with me early on in my career, and then various other charities. And I just felt it was really an honour to be able to help causes that you felt, you know, something for, or even, you know, things that you didn't know about before, but then you were made aware of. So I kind of at the beginning felt it was just a really nice way of lending any kind of publicity to a cause. And then the charities that I tend to have stuck with are the ones that actually are a bit more proactive. It's not just about standing up and doing an auction or standing up and doing a dinner, although those things are great and they're big fundraising pieces. It's getting involved in the research, not actually doing the research, but understanding what the charity does and sitting on a, you know, I've sat on committees that have helped to allocate the funds and things like that. So actually getting a little bit more involved, which is which floats my boat a bit more, I think. And obviously there are so many amazing causes in this country that, you know, we're a really charitable nation and we do such great things. And in lockdown you saw from whether it was Major Tom and his amazing efforts and the country's efforts actually in donating to what he did, to, you know, various, the 26.2 challenges which were going on because there was no marathon.
That's
and,
right.
You know, and I present the marathon for the BBC, so I felt quite close to that actually because I knew that, you know, there's so many charities were going to lose so much funding this year because they weren't getting that money. So it's actually an enjoyable part of what I do and what we do, because Kenny's involved in lots of different things. Mainly at the moment, a lot of his time's taken up with his great pal Doddy Weir, who has motor neuron disease and has just done incredible things.
It's
in terms
phenomenal.
Of things come along in your life, don't they, for different reasons at different times, and they're not always like, I'm president of Muscular Dystrophy UK. Well, nobody in my family has MD, and I didn't, but they asked me because Sue Barker wanted to stand down. Okay. And so she'd done it for 10 years and they said, oh, just come and have a chat with us. And I went totally like with the attitude that I was going to have a nice chat with them and, yeah. you know, that would be it. And of course, they kind of had me at hello. You know, I kind of I came out and went, oh, there was so, you know, because it's yeah. it's such a, you know, an emotive kind of story about, you know, kind of the way the charity started and also what MD, you know, does to actually mainly young boys that right. Suffer. And of course, I've got a 14-year-old who's incredibly sporty.
And he's a giant, incidentally.
Yeah, you bumped into him before.
Enormous.
He's nearly 6'5 now. I keep saying to him, you've stopped. That's it. Yeah. He's nearly 15. So let's say 15 because it's less embarrassing. Because right. yeah. when I say he's 14, people look at me like, you know.
What were you eating when you yeah. were pregnant?
Yeah. And what does he eat now? I mean, he's just like, feeding him in lockdown has just been a joy. Yeah, brilliant. I was like ringing up the school going,
let's get the trough.
Could you send us those lunches that you must give him every day? Because I don't know what you give him. I can't keep him sated. It's not something that you take lightly, committing yourself to different causes. And also you don't want to kind of just go, oh, be involved with, you know, loads of different things. You want to feel something, don't you, for a cause and hopefully help raise profile as well as funds.
Exactly. Are you happy to talk about Daniel?
Yeah, of course.
Because obviously you mentioned it then, your brother died when you were 19, he was 15.
Yeah.
And, you know, if I remember right, you've only told me about this once before when we were having dinner one time, but where you told me is he was playing football with your dad, yeah. I believe, in the garden. And
they were in the garden.
Just sort of fell down.
And he was signed for Leeds United. He was a really brilliant footballer and he was 15 going on 16. That was Bank Holiday Monday in May and he'd played golf with my dad in the morning. They were watching the golf on the telly in the afternoon. It's when the old PGA used to be on the Monday. Yeah. And then my mum and dad were going out for dinner and they went to the garden for a kickabout. I was living in London. My sister was modelling in Japan and my little brother was 6 and they three of them went out into the garden to play together. And he went over to some long grass to get a ball that my dad had just mishit and fell over. And my dad thought he was winding him up and that he was going to turn around and pretend. So my dad kind of gingerly walked over with no urgency at all, thinking that, you know, and when he rolled him over, because he didn't move and he didn't respond, you know, my dad now said, you know, immediately thought that all life had gone at that point. But obviously your natural inclination is to try and bring him around and to, you know, the ambulance was called and they went to hospital and it was all very, you know, rushed and paramedic from next door came around and still his heart wasn't going and his heart never came back and basically had hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, which is the heart becomes very enlarged and just eventually just packs in. Now, people have hypertrophic cardiomyopathies and you know they've got it because they've become breathless or they have other physical symptoms and then they get treatment or they get a heart transplant or, you know, there's all different degrees of ways of, but with a small amount of people, including my brother, there were no symptoms. He didn't ever appear breathless. He was an athlete, you know. Mm. He was just super fit, super healthy, incredibly, you know, vital, you know, just oozed vitality. And his was just a catastrophic heart attack, effectively. So, yeah, it was the most shocking, you know. I always say it's like a sledgehammer came down and just went to the family, kind of, you know, because it just scattered us all, really. He was really, I know people deify the dead and you know, but he was so likable, you know, he had such amazing kind of popularity and everybody just, because he had such talent, but without any arrogance or he just loved his sport. He right. played his sport well and he just wanted to be the best footballer he could be. That was his kind of main aim in life, you know, and he was living his dream, really. Leeds United had just won the league, which was the old
right,
Division One.
Yeah.
So they were just about to start the Premier League. So yeah. he was going to the top club in the country.
Really
and, you know,
times.
Yeah, yeah, so it was really, really exciting. And my parents, I think, felt their three older children were kind of all on their way. You know, my sister was flourishing in her chosen career. I was about to go off to Durham and Danny was starting his career. So I think my parents kind of had this moment earlier in the year that where they'd just gone, yeah. you know, got yeah. our kids have got their wings kind of thing. So. Yeah. Yeah, it was cruel, you know.
That's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
How much does Daniel play a part in your day-to-day life now?
Funny enough, at the moment, quite a lot, because I've been writing a lot in lockdown.
Okay.
And so I'd started writing kind of memoirs, you know, and I actually decided to almost, like, make that a point of the start, because it's almost like there are two halves to my life, in a way, right. because... You know, it does change you. You don't realise at the time how much it changes you. Because when you're 19, you're changing anyway, aren't you? And who are you? Do you know who you are? I don't know if I know who I am. You know, it's that kind of period of change and metamorphosis. And so I've written about him and thought about him a lot in the last few months. And he comes up. Just little things can happen in your day, or somebody, you hear something on the radio and it resonates. And I think the older I get and the more my children start to resemble, you know, who he was at that point. My son's going to be 15 in a few weeks' time, and that is quite poignant as well, you know. So there is definitely periods of my life where he's been less at the forefront of my mind, and then times where, you know, but it's always there, you know, because you, when people say to me things like, you know, how many siblings have you got, without wanting to make them feel uncomfortable, I never want to just say I've got two siblings, you know, because he's still, to me, he's still my brother, you know.
So I lost someone who was very, very dear to me, age 25, and I found, and I don't know if this is similar for you or not, but I found that whilst I was absolutely devastated, it ruined an awful lot about my world, it gave me this sort of need to dive in, mm-hmm. with almost to try and live life faster than ever before, even fast forward. Does that make sense?
And
when I look at your achievements and your career and the fact that I would describe so much of what you do and have done as breathless, you know, almost you haven't stopped from what I can see. You know, you've been this kind of tornado.
There's definitely a sense of seizing the day and then getting hold of it and actually just like strangling it and squeezing it out, you know, to the point where every day had like, you know, as much as it, when our lives first changed, of course, the immediate kind of few months, it's all a bit of a whirlwind. And, you know, my mum was starting what turned out to be a very successful property business, but she just stopped, and she didn't shower, she didn't wash her hair, she just stopped. And so I kind of took on her stuff, you know, and that was the start of it, I guess, the start of the frenetic energy. You know, she'd write a list and say, you need to speak to this builder and this builder, and I'd be driving around Leeds in my Fiat Panda, kind of dropping off wallpaper at buildings that she was, you know, things like that for the summer. So I came home and kind of before I went to university, and then when I got to university, I'd met the guy who would eventually give me a job on Metro FM in Newcastle the previous year, and I rang him straight away and I said, I need to come in to have a chat about how you're going to help me. He said, you're going to help me. And, you know, so it was this kind of like, so it wasn't enough to just have a law degree and get on with that. I was kind of thinking about, so there was, when I was writing all this stuff down recently, I was like, oh my God, I'm amazed I had any friends. Like, I mean, I was literally like, I was annoyed by me writing it. I was like, oh my, the people must have just been going. But actually, it's quite sweet. I've met quite a few people in the last few years who either went to university with me or their siblings did, and things that just at dinners and awards and things, like you come across people. And this one guy I gave an award to at this legal event, and he, on stage, he said, my sister was, and he said her name, and he said, she said, whenever she sees me on telly, she always goes, well, to be fair to her, she used to leave at 2 o'clock in the morning to go and read the news on the local radio station. When we were all coming in, she was screaming, she was running out. And I was like, oh, sorry. And he was like laughing. He goes, no. He goes, she goes, oh, yeah, she always worked hard. And so you kind of don't even know that people, at the time, you didn't realise people noticed. Do you know what I mean? That you were just kind of running around like a lunatic. But I think it was a coping mechanism, obviously. You know, it was a way of kind of dealing with not having to deal with stuff in a way, but also feeling that you're going to live life for two people and you're going to get out there and you're going to make his life count in some way. It can't last, you know, at some point you just go, and that happens.
Exhaustion.
You know, my second year at university, I went to the doctors to get sleeping pills because I just couldn't sleep, because sometimes the flip side of being like that is that you stop sleeping almost. Mm. And we had exams coming up, it was his anniversary, you know, and instead of the doctor sitting down and working, wondering why this apparently healthy 20-year-old wanted to put herself to sleep at night and talk to me, he just signed off some sleeping tablets.
Really?
And I think this is the mark of where we've come, actually, with mental health. It wouldn't happen now. And I don't, you know, he was an old doctor I'd never met before. I'd never even been to the doctors when I was at university. So he had no history about my family or anything. And so I went back to my room and telling my mum, and I wasn't really telling my mum lots of stuff because I didn't want to put extra stress on her. Yeah. And then my dad rang me up and said, look, I've used sleeping tablets all my life and they don't work, and, you know, don't take them. And I remember throwing them away thinking, they don't ask me to do much, so I'll do that. And I'm so kind of like, it could have been, I think, a very... Not that, you know, I would have taken too many sleeping tablets. It's just not a good place to be, is it, when you're 20 years old?
No.
Yeah, and it also highlighted to me that there was something wrong with not sleeping. Do you know what I mean? I was like, started thinking about that more, and then I kind of started to speak to people and got some counselling, which is what I needed, really.
Right.
So it was quite a good wake-up call at that point, but it could have gone badly wrong, really.
I don't really know how we change tack for something as serious as this. So I'm just going to dive in at the deep end. I've had a nice old look through everything that you have hosted over the years.
What?
So much of it I have been aware of. I mean, obviously, I've watched you on every sport going. But something stood out that I have to ask you about because I don't know if it's real. Right, you probably know where I'm going. It involves sheep.
Yeah, I knew you were going to say that.
Is that real?
Yeah.
Flock
stuff,
isn't it?
Just the one series, which it sounded like it. It sounded to me, right? I thought this sounds like
it's not a joke. It really
no, I thought this could be like Bake Off. You know, this could be like the next Bake Off because it's kind of this beautiful country activity.
Yeah.
And when I went to
remind me of the premise.
So the premise was that you get a group of celebrities,
yeah,
and they learn how to shepherd, basically.
Right.
So with proper sheepdogs,
yeah,
they have different trials. So they have
and real sheep.
Real sheep, real different kinds of sheep. We even did ducks as well.
Wow.
Because sheepdogs do, you know. So I went along to the for a day of filming just to see these sheepdogs in action, to get a sense of what was going to happen on the show.
Yeah.
And I came home and was like, oh my God, it's just a beauty. And the place was, you know, the Oast houses in Kent.
Yeah,
it was just
yeah.
beautiful. It was amazing place. Like, this is gonna be amazing. I don't know where, what day of the shoot I realised we were never going to have a second series was, but it was really surreal. I mean, that's, yeah. you know, you can't really, can you imagine, like, we were like, working with that many animals
yes.
and a group of celebrities who kind of, you know, didn't really know what was going on. Some of them were very competitive and wanted to really nail it. And,
wow.
Yeah,
it I was... really need to get that yeah. sheep in the pen. Come
yeah,
on.
It was, yeah, it was very, very funny and... very, I think, one-off. Let's just say it was a one-off. I did this show Splash for a couple of series with Vernon
Kay. Yeah, the diving board.
Yeah, which was also a slightly, you know, left-field kind of activity to be doing in, you know, in a reality setting. But I really enjoyed the process and, you know, I thought, oh, well, this might have that kind of element of fun to it. But, yeah, I think the reason ITV put it on, I think it was 2:15, like, minute parts. It was like a half-an-hour show.
Right.
So probably 13-minute parts. Original plan was an hour. So they squeezed it into like
wow.
26 minutes and
yeah.
then shoved it on a Tuesday night at kind of like 8:30.
Well, there's only so long you can see someone in a pair of speeders going, oh, I don't know. I don't know if I... Oh, I'll do it.
Yeah. Well, two series of Splash we managed to get.
That's
so,
pretty good.
Yeah.
That's pretty good. Now, there is a side to you that the public don't know a huge amount about, but I think they should. But that is comedy.
Oh.
You wonder where I was going there.
Yeah,
no. Like,
I was thinking, oh,
what?
God.
I was getting the eyes. No, because you've been writing some comedy. You've got some comedy characters. You know, when are we going to see more of?
Well, I think I did a thing for Comic Relief, a stand up for Comic Relief.
Yeah.
And there were five of us: Tyson Fury, and Michael Vaughan, and myself, Razor Ruddock. Who was the fifth person? Anyway, there were five of us, and I was the only woman, and we all had mentors. Mine was Paddy Keelty. And you had to write your material and then deliver it at the Bloomsbury Theatre live with a 500-strong audience.
Yeah.
And I absolutely loved it. I loved the process and I loved, you know, I was more nervous than anything in my whole life before I went on stage. But once you land that first laugh, it is just the most, you can see, it's addictive, you know.
Yeah.
I went to bed that night, that was it. I was giving all sport up. I was just going to be a stand-up comic. There was nothing else like it. You know, I literally was lying in bed writing material till about 3 a.m. in my head. And then you wake up, the kids need breakfast.
Yeah.
You have to go on Match of the Day. You've got this. And real life gets in the way again. And I think it's... I really admire my friend John Bishop for giving everything up at the age of 40
yeah.
to do... you know, he used to be a salesman because actually it's a much easier game if you're 19 and you're gigging in pubs and you're... I don't mean easier, but at least
yeah.
you can kind of like grow your... And he was interesting. He said that when he started out, obviously he was like the uncle, you know what I mean? Because
yeah.
like he was this older guy, all these young, the places he was performing in were these upstairs at pubs and things. But he said, actually, the comedy world, it doesn't matter who you are, what age you are, there's such appreciation for what you're doing and how tough it is that it doesn't matter. Because I said, did you never feel like, you know, they're all looking at you thinking, well, you've just turned up in your Sierra or
yeah.
whatever you've driven
yeah.
and, you know, and they're all getting the bus and stuff. And he said, no, everybody appreciates how hard it is. So it doesn't matter what age you are. So and there's a bit of me that regrets not just striking a bit more while the iron was hot with my enthusiasm back then, which was about 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Because now it just feels like, you know, implausible.
Well, you didn't.
But, no, I think I like, you know, I really enjoy writing and I'm trying to kind of write humour into what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And but the actual thought of, mind you, right now, I mean, stand-up comedy is... probably one of the last things that truly comes back in the way it did before, isn't it?
So yes, I mean, there is Zoom comedies,
yeah,
and drive-in,
yeah,
and things
the
like
drive-ins
that.
But, look, yeah, quite interesting, don't, yeah, they? But hopefully they'll somehow, that industry will kind of find a way of monetizing what they do.
So if I randomly booked you in for 5 nights at the Pleasance next year's Edinburgh Fringe,
I'll be up for it. Yeah,
you would be,
yeah,
up for it.
I'd
though,
take the challenge.
You?
I'd take the challenge, yeah, if somebody. In fact, that's what I said to Kenny. I'd do. I said, right, I'm just going to book a venue at Edinburgh.
And, you totally should.
And then I'll just
sell out like that.
And then I have to. Well, I have to write something then. Do you know what I mean? You have,
yeah.
Once you've got the venue, you have to kind of go for it, don't you? So maybe next year. I'm 50 in 2023. So maybe I should do it in my 50th year. That would be my present to myself.
I had you down as younger. I mean,
no, you didn't. You've done all your research.
No, I have done my research, but I had forgotten because I'm sitting here looking at something that doesn't look.
But you know what's weird about aging? The last 10 years have gone so quickly. Like, I felt like I was in my 30s for so long. And
right.
I turned 40, and now I'm 47. It's just, the 40s just go. They just fly.
I'm getting even nearer, Gabby. I look significantly older than you, and I'm a bit younger than you.
You
a little
not.
Bit.
You look about 28.
But I look in the mirror, and there's a smashed up old tea bag looking back at me these days. And I'm like, wow. And that's when I don't smile. Then it's a, you know.
But that's the, but none of that matters, I've decided, because I've got beyond that age of, do you know what I mean? You just think, oh, well, none of that really matters anymore. You just have to kind of like keep your spirit and your energy up, I think is the, and health. Being healthy is like, you know, the main thing, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Because if you're not healthy, it's hard to do any of the things you want to do. So I'm not going to say you never say never, but it does feel like I might have just missed that boat.
No, we just agreed. 50th birthday. 5 nights
empty
at the
theatre. Empty theatre in Edinburgh.
I'll be there.
Oh,
I'll be there every night.
It's my poor daughter. She was in a play that was going to be at Edinburgh this summer. Oh, so I know. We booked a flat on Airbnb and everything. We were all excited about going up to watch her. So they're going to go next year, hopefully. But
it's amazing.
I did a play there when I was at university for a week, and it is, to be part of that whole festival is so much fun and such a, it's crazy, you know, like there were 9 of us in a bedroom in Edinburgh when we were staying in this apartment, 9 in each, in because all the crew who set the, you know, the show up, as well as the actors, and it's great, great fun.
My thanks to Gabby Logan, and let's hope we do see her at the Edinburgh Festival next year. How cool would that be? Now, after the break, another, well, very entertaining person on the way. Judge Rinder joins me on Driven.
Driven with Andy J on Talk Radio, in association with Paramex Digital. You dream it, we bring it to life. Find out more at drivenchat.com.
Welcome back to Driven here on Talk Radio, powered by Paramex Digital, proud creators of drivenchat.com. Now, I am thrilled to be able to welcome my next guest. I say thrilled, I'm also slightly nervous because he once famously said that he is never wrong. It is Mr. Rob Rinder, aka Judge Rinder. I don't know whether to call you Rob or Judge or Mr. Rinder or Sir. What would you like?
All of the above, depending on the nature of your question, but you're definitely right to be afraid. It is exhausting to be as never wrong as I am, I have to tell you. I spend my days completely, practically in a coma with my right.
I mean, look, it's something you're famed for. Everybody knows because we've all seen the show. We've all watched Judge Rinder, and you obviously preside over these disputes and you make a ruling and all the rest of it. But have you found that there's a knock-on effect that you get people approaching you in supermarkets and stuff saying, listen, I picked that up first, it's mine, isn't it? Or things like that.
No, fun if I don't get conscripted into a deal with personal disputes between people. But what I have noticed is that I think because people, when they see me, think that I have the power to send them to prison, is that they're always incredibly kind, mindful and thoughtful before approaching, and generally just really nice. At first I thought that was just me and they could detect a sense of benevolence in me, you know, they knew that I was a kind person. But as I say, now I realize it's because they think I have police powers.
It would be nice to have police powers, but I think you're quite happy where you're at, right? You have better than police powers. You have showbiz power.
Yeah, that's a great power there, isn't it? Thank you. The showbiz power I do have, when people do stop you, not to arbitrate a dispute, but they want a selfie, or they watch the show, or, you know, they've been in lockdown and they've got addicted to it. That's always nice. What is the showbiz power? What are you talking about? What showbiz power?
You've the power to stop people, the power to move people, the power that people want to take multiple photographs of you whenever possible. You know, the power that you walk
down the street.
Well, that's
just egomania.
Goes, oh, hang on, there's Rob Rinder over there.
But that's just egomania, isn't it? I mean, but that, you know, before the lockdown, I used to write a lot about this stuff. These sort of whinging celebrity types, the celebristocracy, you know, the ones that do sort of videos about how important their political views are, and don't get me started, or things will get better. And thank goodness You've told us about that behind, you know, your locked gate as you're secluded in your multi-million pound home surrounded by people that are there to assist you. Anyway, with that throat clearing about celebrities, let's go on to another one, which is that, you know, you get to improve the chemistry of someone's day simply by being around because they've enjoyed the program or learned something from it or whatever. I've got no time for these whinging celebrity types that complain, oh, you know, somebody asked me for a selfie, I've got no privacy. I mean, there's no part of me that doesn't want to react and say, when you get yourself a real job.
I was told by my first ever producer, I started out on Kids Telly, and he said to me, look, Andy, however you're feeling, you have to imagine that you're being beamed into a nursing home and they've taken the remote control away. So you are stuck on that person's telly. They have no choice but to watch you. You owe it to them to be the best you every time. That responsibility remains. Don't you think? You always have to just give your best.
I mean, I make a number of shows, as you know, but on the court show, it's different because we film it as live. And so we'll do between 6 and sometimes even 9 cases in a day. And they'll last an hour. You might only see 15 minutes of it on television. But I always give the best I possibly can. But that's a kind of professional thing. I really care about the integrity of the show. But in a personal way, you know, if you're walking down the street, is what I mean. Or the reality is that you are only there because people want to watch you. As I say, it's why I've got precisely no time for people in the public eye of whatever stripe or variety, you know, grumbling about invasion of privacy, for example. You're perfectly able to curate your life, you know, if you're an A-list person in a way which guarantees that you are not overlooked or onlooked, especially. You know, we all know the people we know little about, and well, we respect people who conduct their lives in that way. It's when people use the press or complain about public intrusion, or where, you know, they complain about those people, meaning the people that pay their salaries and watch their programmes, that I have a real grumble and complaint.
And let's talk about you in lockdown, though, because, of course, you know, right now things are on pause. We can't do a great deal of right. filming in particular. And obviously, for your show, that would be a particularly challenging Impossible. Show to do right now. So how are you getting on? What is day-to-day for you?
Well, I'm sort of doing a number of things, but chiefly working on my eating. That's my day is completely curated around what's in the fridge. I'm like my grandma used to be when you'd go on holiday with her. You know, it was sort of 7 o'clock in the morning and she was determining what we were going to have for lunch. That's what I do all day, pretty much. I eat. So that's it. None of my clothes fit me. I was thrilled when one of those big delivery sports stores opened, because now I just sort of live in tracksuit bottom. Yeah. I mean, I'm writing a book, I'm writing various other things, and I write columns, as you know, in various papers. But yeah, most of the time, if I'm not, as I'm looking at him now, sort of trying to cajole my snoring, farting dog, who's ostensibly a rug with eyes, into a walk. And even then, he can only sort of summon up the energy to go to the park. I'll be eating. Is pretty much what I do. Reading and eating
sounds pretty great. I mean, if your dog is anything like my neighbour's dog, then he's just got absolutely sick of all the walks. Like my neighbours at the moment, there's now so they all descended from university, moved back in with their mum, so there's now like 5 of them, and that dog is taken out about 20 times a day. And you could just see after the second walk, you could just see it's like, I'm done. I don't want another walk.
Yeah, my dog wouldn't tolerate that. I mean, I tried, because I used to, you know, be quite, I did an ultra marathon in February across Namibia, so it wasn't like that long ago. So it's still like a distant memory, doesn't it? You know, every time I sort of talk about things that happened in January, I feel like I should don't do this at home, but, you know, sort of light a cigarette and then reminisce about the old times. That's how different the world feels. But no, I took him jogging once. We went about 100 yards and he just sat down and looked at me. I mean, he's a French bulldog, which means he is really his own brother-in-law, you know. He just sort of looked up at me and just went, what do you think you're doing? Just no way. I went on a long walk the other day and we got quite far and he got attacked by a cat and I had to pick him up and carry him home. It was sort of, you know, it was like the last scene of film. I could hear Chariot of Fire in my ears. One thing I am doing, which I am pleased about, and it's a real privilege to be able to do, is answer people's legal questions. And I do that either on social media, if possible, sometimes on This Morning. And that really matters because, you know, I have to tell you, having been practicing for close for 20 years, which is a terrifying thought, there are things that are emerging now that genuinely you sort of study law and you study the history of law, but you think that certain things have been consigned to the dustbin of history. Honestly, looking at cases and people with financial and consequent legal issues that we haven't really thought about since the Second World War. That's how serious. That's been a privilege to help people. Yeah.
I mean, the world is turned upside down. I mean, you know, I used the quote earlier about how you're never wrong. So maybe you can help us with this. You know, there's the before that you just mentioned, which is, as you say, even January, February 2020 feels like a lifetime ago. Then there's the during, which we're all going through at the moment, which is surreal and new and weird, and we're adapting and adjusting and finding new ways to figure things out. And then, of course, there's the after. So I'm asking you, because I like you to be the purveyor of all knowledge, what happens next? What is the after? What is what we will call the new normal?
You know, there are three things. Firstly, I have, you know, limitless capacity to believe genuinely in humanity's capacity for compassion and kindness, to repair themselves, hope, in other words. So I do think that the economic recovery will be quicker than people think. You know, people use examples in history. The only one that we've got of any meaningful kind are the World Wars. And prior to the Second World War, of course, the Wall Street crash. But of course, there weren't the social structures in place that we have now, the welfare state, etc. You know, the government's relationship with individuals wasn't like it is now. And so there is the capacity more quickly to recover, despite people perhaps believing we haven't made progress. We actually have. You know, if you look what happened in the 30s, it was the early 30s before the recovery. It was total calamity. Secondly, I think that there's been such a craving for human touch, and it has been such a challenging situation. And I think it might be a mirror of what happened when we last experienced something vaguely similar, which I suppose, if we look into history, is the crash and the war. And what we tend to find is, after great big massive social calamity, we have a kind of decade of partying and recovery and joy, you know, the roaring 20s. I think it's going to be, you know, a massively debauched Ibiza-style party. I mean, I'll be too old to join in. But that being said, I really do think there's a desire for people and for a society to recover quickly. Thirdly, I have to say there's a lot of things we can't predict in the short term, and that is really worrying. I mean, in the long term, I think we'll be okay. In the short term, I think there are employment and other issues, financial issues that individuals are going to experience, which we've only touched the tip of a pretty terrifying iceberg over. What we will see. But a lot of jobs are not going to come back quickly. A lot of people that are on furlough are going to find themselves redundant in the process of the airline industry finding its feet again. People are going to be out of work. And of course, it's all of the consequent things for our economy. It's going to be pretty bad for a very long time. In terms of the disease, I'm no Dr. Fauci, but again, I'm pretty hopeful about that. I think we've learned a lot from it, and I suspect in a year or so's time, it'll be a thing of history.
Let's hope so. Do you think, slightly more trivial, do you think handshakes will return, or do you think we're done with them?
I hope so. I can't bear this rubbish. I mean, you know, I can't remember, it was some celebrity. I'm sure she was well-meaning. I'm sure she doesn't actually like being touched by the public. You know, you have to. But, you know, somebody either tweeted or said, oh, it's so great that, you know, I mean, I come back to what I said before, that people can't shake hands or hug you or ask for selfies because then you have to be touched. I mean, pull yourself together.
Yeah.
One of the great joys, one of the great functions of being a human being in society is to reach out, is to shake hands. There's a reason why that's, you know, evolved kind of socially and culturally across the globe, certainly in Western culture. It matters to be alongside one another. It's a thing that people who are alone perhaps crave most. So no, I'm all for handshaking and hugging, and obviously within reason, and not at work with people you don't know. I really hope it does. You know, the sooner the better.
Yeah, I
see. You know what it's like when you've socially distanced and you've seen a friend, and there's this kind of weird moment. We can't.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's the first thing you want to do. You don't greet each other with people your word.
No, absolutely. It's very peculiar. Bring back hugs as fast as we possibly can within, obviously, right, health limitations, obviously. But one of the things that's very, very clear to me is you're very much a people person, aren't you? You feed off people. You're excited by people. You're interested in people. You know, it certainly feels to me like that's one of your driving factors. Our show's called Driven, and I like to know what drives people to do better and to achieve great things. And I get the feeling from you that actually it's other people.
I mean, ultimately, my motivation to succeed in things is mine. It's a complicated question you ask. in terms of what drives me, it's always sort of, it's internally motivated. And I think there are great pitfalls and dangers, for example, in trying to assess or determine where you are by virtue of looking at other people. It's important to rely on them, to be sure. Never determine or think about your success based on what other people are doing, and I never do that. In terms of being a people person, absolutely. In terms of my endless and limited capacity to be limitlessly delighted by people and to believe in them. And despite, I suppose, how you frame me, which is perfectly reasonable, about being judgmental, I am judgmental, but only on people's actions. Person's education, inverted commas, you know, any fool can read a book. I give that sort of my undivided indifference. Very often a person's experience is interesting, but not if it's a list of things that they've done on the CV. Who cares? You know, it's about how culturally curious you are, how interested in the world you are, your capacity to hear and listen. Being surrounded by people like that is very important to me and definitely drive.
My thanks to Judge Rinder and, of course, Gabby Logan and Katie Mellower for their company on the show today. And a special thanks, of course, to you for listening. Don't forget, you can head to drivenchat.com where you can download the podcasts, Driven Celebrities, where you can hear the back catalogue of all the celebrities we've spoken to so far, and our automotive spin-off show, Driven Chat, which is, well, if you're a petrol head, it's just up your street. Now, next week, we have another very special show for you because I've been lucky enough to have a full hour sit down with Top Gear and Grand Tour legend James May. And my word, we've got a lot to chat about. So James May is a full show super guest next week. You've been listening to me, Andy J, on Driven on Talk Radio.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.